From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. There was no DNA evidence, questionable witness testimony, and shoddy lawyering. And yet it took less than an hour for a jury to convict Daryl Burton of murder. He was 22 when he was sentenced to spend the rest of his life in the Missouri State Penitentiary. And on the day of his sentencing, he told the judge that he would prove that he was innocent. Daryl Burton did just that, but it took 24 years of incarceration before he was exonerated of the crime and set free. Today on the program, Daryl Burton joins us to tell his dramatic story and what happens when the criminal justice system gets it wrong. Plus, what is Diwali? We'll learn more about the Hindu Festival of Lights. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. He pleaded not guilty to a St. Louis murder, but a jury took less than an hour to convict Daryl Burton of capital murder. At age 22, Burton got a life sentence, and it took 24 years for the wrongful conviction to be overturned. Today on the program, we're talking with Burton about his search for justice. Daryl Burton was exonerated in 2008. He's now a motivational speaker who shares his story with colleges, youth groups, and churches around the globe, and he's in Salt Lake City today. He joins us in studio. Daryl, good morning. Thanks so much for the time.
No, thank you. Good morning.
Also with us, Jency Anderson. She is a clinical professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. She's also president of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center, and she litigates innocence and wrongful conviction claims throughout the state. Jency, great to have you here. Thanks so much for your time as well.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Daryl Burton will speak about his exoneration today, Thursday, November 29th at 12:15 in the Sutherland Moot Courtroom at the S.J. Quinney College of Law. The event is free and open to the public and includes a complimentary lunch. You can find out more information on our website, kcpw.org. Later on in the program, we'll turn to religion. We learn more about the Hindu Festival of Lights, Diwali. But first, innocence and justice. If you've got questions or comments for Daryl Burton about his exoneration and life after imprisonment, you can join us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. As I mentioned, Daryl, you were exonerated in 2008. Describe that first day of freedom for us.
Unbelievable. It was surreal. Having spent 24 years in prison wrongfully, you never know if it's going to ever happen, if you're going to get out. But I can just say I give God the glory, and I thank God for allowing me to be here today, to be anywhere in the free world, because that's an experience I don't wish on anyone. It's an evil place, and no one should have to go through that, not in America, not anywhere.
What was going through your mind when you left the prison for the first time?
Almost the same. It was the reverse of what happened when I got found guilty. Shock, disbelief, except for the anger. I was very angry going in and full of hate. But joy and hope. Hope. I had a lot of hope when I come out. And so just looking for what I was going to be experiencing out here in the free world. I hadn't been here in almost a quarter century. So I had no clue about anything.
What were some of the changes that you noticed right away, how life in the world was so different from the world that you left behind?
Technology. I've never seen a cell phone. I never used a cell phone. They give me this little thing in the palm of my hand and said, call anywhere, use 10 digits, and then just start talking. But I had nothing by my mouth. So when I called my mother, I started yelling because I didn't know she could hear me. And they, what are you yelling for? I said, you all can hear me, because I just wasn't used to talking with just something that by my ear. Mm. And it wasn't a Bluetooth, but it was just a really little small cell phone. But knowing how to use a debit card, I mean, when someone asked for my PIN number, I gave it to them. I didn't know I wasn't supposed to give the 4 digits to people. I mean, automatic toilets flushing in public restrooms. I mean, just A lot of things. Didn't know how to turn on the television. I thought it was voice activated because I didn't see any buttons on this television that a lady gave me. I didn't know. So
it's interesting. I mean, you're mentioning things that I think people today wouldn't even think twice about.
Right.
And yet it was all so new.
Right. And I just, before I left, I mean, a lot of things I used to take for granted. It's like when you grow up, in a culture, just little things, little changes, maybe subtle or whatever, you just don't recognize them. You don't really pay any attention. But if you've been gone and come back, there's so many things that can change within a year, especially with technology. 2 years, 10. I mean, it's unbelievable. Mm. And I'm still not able to catch up with computers. computers is sometimes, and my wife, she's an IT, so she helps me with that part of it.
You'll get there. I want to bring listeners up to speed on your story. In July 1984, you were arrested for a murder. A man named Mo Ball, I guess he was a known drug dealer in St. Louis where you were living. Why were you fingered in the crime?
The victim's family members, they brought me into the crime. They said either I was responsible or another gentleman was responsible for killing a loved one. You know, nothing connected me to the crime. No fingerprints, no DNA, no weapon, confession, no motive. Except they had a couple of snitch witnesses. The other gentleman who fit the description, and you know, I mean, I didn't even fit the description. They said it was a short, medium to light-skinned guy. And as you can see, I'm not 7 feet, but I would never be light-skinned, you know. I mean, the palm of my hands is darker than everybody in this room, but the open palm. But the other gentleman who fit the description had shot, you know, the victim, Donald Ball, 3 different times because they was in heated drug turf war, and they had shot him. So my public defender and the prosecutor and the judge, they had a sidebar, and they knew about this here, but only 3 of them discussed it in the courtroom. I didn't find out about it until after I got convicted, but they said, yeah, they knew about this other suspect shooting this victim, but they're not going to let the jury hear about that. So they kept that away from the jury. They never revealed that. And so the other gentleman told people he was going to finish this guy off. They was going to finish each other off because they were shooting at each other and each other's associates for a while. So it was known. It was known in the community.
Mm. I understand that you met with your public defender just once before a 2-day trial. I mean, what was going through your mind during that trial period? If you had no connection to this guy, you didn't even know who he was, that must have been shocking.
Yeah, no, I knew him. I knew the victim. The victim, you know, we grew up together. I mean, I was very, you know, familiar with the victim. We was like friends. He was, in fact, one of my brother's best friend, my oldest brother. So I knew him. But I saw her one time, and I was just wanting to get out. I mean, my whole thinking was just get me out of here. I didn't know if she was going to be the right person or not. But if she was my lawyer, I was ready to go to trial. I was ready to go to trial day one. I mean, what I thought would just take 24 hours to resolve, I never thought it would be 24 years later. So I wanted to just get into a courtroom, and I knew it would be, I thought, easy to prove that I'm innocent. I don't fit the description. I didn't do it, no motive. But it just didn't turn out like that. And justice system just don't work like that. You're not, they say presumption of innocence stay with you, but not really. You actually, when you get arrested for something and something serious, it's usually, the thought is, you're guilty. You better prove yourself innocent.
As I mentioned, the jury deliberated for a very short time. You were convicted of capital murder and sentenced to life. How did you react in the courtroom that day?
I was very angry, very, very angry. I mean, shocked and confused, but I mean, I couldn't believe the verdict. It happened so fast, it just make your head swim. And when they brought me over for sentencing, and I challenged the judge, the court, I told the judge, you know, Your Honor, all due respect, the prosecutor, defense attorney, the police, these witnesses, all of you part of this conspiracy. You confiscate my freedom. You framing me. And, of course, he said, I didn't find you guilty. Your lawyer didn't find you guilty. You mad at anyone, be mad at the jurors. That's who found you guilty. And I just said, well, you have the power to overturn this conviction because you saw those people coming here and lying me. You saw it. How could you not see it? It's just obvious. You know, you had 2 witnesses never giving the same story, never giving that identification of me. Then they didn't disclose the deals either, and that was another thing. That was a problem. They really didn't disclose the deals with these guys. So, I mean, I didn't find all this out until many years later. But I just feel like these are the legal professionals. They know when something is just not coming together. And they knew about this other suspect that none of the jurors, not even I knew, that they had talked about. So they was aware of all this here, you know. And I'm just, you know, it just appalls me that they not only did it to me, but they've done it to so many other people around this nation. And it still happens. It happens in Utah. It happens in Missouri, New York. It happens. You see it on TV, especially now with DNA. DNA has freed a lot of people. But there's a lot of non-DNA people who are in there who are innocent, just like I was.
Daryl Burton. He was exonerated in 2008. He is in Salt Lake City to share his story of freedom. Also with us, Jency Anderson, clinical professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah and president of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. And you can join us if you have questions or comments about innocence, about wrongful convictions. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Jency Anderson, Daryl is saying he's not alone.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. Daryl's story is not unique. I mean, there have been 300 plus people exonerated by DNA evidence, and at least 600, if not many more, who have been exonerated by non-DNA evidence, or where there was no physical evidence available. And estimates are that at least 5% of our prison population is innocent, which is an appalling number. And these wrongful convictions really show that there are flaws and fissures in our criminal justice system.
Well, can you walk us through the factors that lead to a wrongful conviction? In Daryl's case, clearly the lawyering wasn't there. I mean, there was some pretty shoddy attorney work going on there. What else was going on? And what other factors lead to these wrongful convictions?
Well, the leading cause of wrongful conviction in this country is mistaken or false eyewitness identification. In about 70% of the DNA exonerations, there's been at least one mistaken eyewitness. And in Daryl's case, it wasn't a mistaken eyewitness. It was an eyewitness who had not told the truth, and then another eyewitness who had been suppressed. An eyewitness came forward after Daryl was proclaiming his innocence, who said it wasn't Daryl who did it. But originally it was two eyewitnesses who told the jury they'd seen him do it. And that's one of the problems we see, is that juries and judges tend to believe eyewitnesses because they can't believe they would lie or that they would be mistaken. And despite the fact that it's been shown over and over again that eyewitness ID is incredibly fallible, that's one of the leading causes of wrongful conviction in this country. The bad lawyering, of course, is a problem. The suppression of evidence by prosecutors, which also happened in Daryl's case, or by police. The destruction of evidence by prosecutors or police. The use of incorrect forensic evidence, the use of false confessions, the use of snitch testimony, those are all really pillars of the wrongful conviction debate and what's going on in this country. And those are the things that have really come to light as we've looked at wrongful convictions in the United States.
That's a lot of things that can go wrong then.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that can go wrong. And one of the things that we as Innocence Projects do is we not only hope to get people out of prisons, but we hope that we can make the public aware that there are problems in the criminal justice system that need to be addressed.
We're talking about wrongful convictions and the exoneration of Daryl Burton, who was exonerated in 2008 after 24 years in prison. 801-355-TALK is our number if you'd like to join us. Daryl Burton will be speaking about his experience today, Thursday, November 29th at 12:15 in the Sutherland Moot Courtroom at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. The event is free and open to the public and includes a complimentary lunch. And again, you can join us if you like. 801-355-TALK is the number. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking with Daryl Burton, who spent 24 years behind bars in the Missouri State Pen for a crime he did not commit. He was set free in 2008, and he's in Salt Lake City to share his story at the University of Utah. He's speaking today at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at 12:15. And the event is free and open to the public. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join us, if you've got questions about the Innocence Project or Daryl's experience, feel free to call us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Also with us in studio, Jency Anderson, a clinical professor of law at the Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. She's also the president of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. This call from Ray from Salt Lake City, he couldn't stay on the line. He says he was sentenced for a crime he did commit, but that he knew other people in prison who he believed were innocent and thinks this has a lot to do with race. Daryl, what do you think?
Yes, race play a factor in some cases, but not all, because there's a common theme about those of us who get sent to prison who are innocent, black, white, Hispanic, male, female, is that we're just poor. That's the common thread. When you don't have resources, when you really don't have money, because, I mean, I have exoneree friends from all around the country, you know, male and female, and they all nationalities. And we all have the same common problem. You know, when we went to trial, we didn't have money. We just didn't have the resources. So that's what it comes down to. I mean, but by and large, in the county that I was exonerated out of in St. Louis, about another 8 to 10 people who were exonerated. Now, all of us are African Americans, every one of us. You know, there's about, I don't know, statewide out of Missouri, there's about 15 to 20 people who've been exonerated, but not from the county that I was from. So, I mean, in that county, there's a problem in that county. So every one of us, there was a woman and about 8 of us men who was exonerated, but all of us are African American. So that's the question of race that, you know, has to be addressed in that county.
Jency, the issue of race, or is it money? Access to good legal counsel, access to good evidence?
I mean, the fact of the matter is it can happen to anyone. It can happen to anyone of any color, of any race, of any social class. The fact is, however, that it more often happens to poor people, and it more often happens to people of color. I mean, we find that that is one of the causes of wrongful conviction, that of those who have been exonerated, that there is a large percentage of those that there's been some sort of racial issue, whether it was the race of the victim as compared to the race of the accused, or simply the race of the accused. That's certainly an issue that we have seen as a problem. And that's not a surprise. I mean, it's been a problem in the administration of the death penalty. It's been a problem in the way that drug crimes are sentenced. It's been a problem in our criminal justice system for some time. But as Daryl says, there's also a class issue of individuals. I mean, although we certainly have people of wealth who have been wrongfully convicted, the majority are those who are people who don't necessarily have the money to fight the system.
Ray, thanks so much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Talking about wrongful convictions and the exoneration of Daryl Burton, who's speaking at the law school at the University of Utah today. 801-355-TALK is the number. Daryl, you were sent to prison for this crime that you didn't commit. Your journey to prove your innocence began there. You spent days poring over books in the prison law library, but about a year after your incarceration, I understand you received a letter, an affidavit. What did it say?
Yeah, it was an affidavit, a little less than a year, from the guy who testified against me, the key witness for the state. And he said in the letter that he had wanted to recant and retract his testimony because he had lied on me. I don't know if he thought I was going to get the death penalty or what, his conscience was bothering him. But he said he submitted perjured testimony in my case, and he wanted to retract it, wanted to recant and take it back. And none of this evidence really, you know, penetrated in the system. And so the defense attorney, the prosecutor, nobody tried to get on top of this information. Nobody tried to go and get this guy, you know, filed for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence or anything. So it just went, you know, unheard for many years.
That must have been so frustrating. Here you've got a letter, the golden ticket, out of prison, and nobody's paying attention.
Right. I mean, it was an affidavit. Yes, I was, you know, and I, like I say again, I was trying to believe in the process. So I had this appeal, you know, that was pending. So I was thinking that it would hopefully get presented in the appeal some kind of way. I didn't understand the procedures, you know, the legal procedures. So, and these rules and time factors. But I'm thinking the lawyer is going to, you know, take care of all of this here, and it just never happened. So I just had to take it upon myself to do this, you know, for myself, pro se, and act as my own attorney. And so, I mean, when I got into the prison system, I started reading the law books and taking law classes and started fighting my case.
I understand that you also wrote a ton of letters to anybody who would possibly listen. And finally, in 2000, somebody responded, the Centurion Ministries, which looks at convictions of the wrongfully accused. You must have been just completely thrilled after so many years of silence.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wrote the first letter to them in 1990. The first letter, because I saw them on television, helping a lady get out of prison in Texas who had served 9 years for a murder she didn't commit. So I wrote them in 1990. They wrote me back and basically said, you know, yes, they help free innocent people, but they, you know, don't really have a lot of money and resources. and said it would take 10 years before they got to my case. And sure enough, it was 10 years later in 2000 when they got to my case. 8 years after that, they got me exonerated. But just to have somebody working for you and fighting for you, an Innocence Project, an Innocence Group, law students, lawyers pro bono, you know, that is just, for me, it was a godsend because I had done everything I could do in my own abilities, and it's just nothing was working. So you need outside help, and those people who are inside, they need outside help. They really need outside help.
They appealed your case to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. That claim was denied. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court. That was turned down. It looked pretty bleak. And then there was an opening when the Missouri Supreme Court ruled that innocence claims deserved a second chance. I mean, what a relief for you.
That was a miracle, sincerely a miracle. You're right. The federal courts basically said that my case troubled them. They was very troubled. In the conservative court, they said my case presented mounting claims of evidence that suggested that I was innocent, but they had impediments erected by courts and by Congress that would not allow them to get over the hurdle and the threshold to look at the merits of my claims of innocence. And they said they hope Missouri, you know, through the judicial or the executive branch, take a second look at my case. When I'm thinking, you have the first look. You're a federal court. You're superior than state courts. But anyway, they passed it, kicked the can down the road, and Missouri came back and they, you know, took a second look at this case, and you know, and therefore gave me a relief and gave me redress I was seeking, which was innocence. But it took 24 years, you know, to right a wrong. I can't get those years back.
Jency, when we hear cases like Darryl's, I mean, it makes you really reflect, what is wrong with the system? And how can we fix it? If he's got a letter from the key witness in the case recanting the testimony, I mean, how do you wave that flag? I mean, I'm sure that there are others out there who are in a similar position. How do you get the attention of the legal community and the support of the lawyers out there?
Well, I think, you know, part of it is continuing to do this work and continuing to expose flaws in the system. And I think as Innocence Projects, we've really been able to do that. There are many states now that are looking at how to perfect eyewitness testimony or how to avoid false confessions or how to fund their public defender's offices better so that there's not such ineffective assistance of counsel. But there and passing legislation that begins to address this. I mean, the fact of the matter is a person like Darryl, who's been convicted, really faces an amazing number of hurdles to get back into the system to prove his innocence. You know, he had this affidavit, and it took him 24 years to get a court to listen to it. And that's partially because the system puts such hurdles in the way of an innocent person in getting back into court. In Utah, actually, we are one of the more progressive states, and we have two statutes that allow innocent people back into prison, one with for people who have DNA evidence and one for people who don't have DNA evidence, which is really progressive for a state. We are one of two states in the nation that has this. And I think as citizens, we should be incredibly proud of this. And if this our statutes come up for attack, which is always possible, that we'd speak with our legislators and say this is a really important place for us to be, a place that recognizes that there are flaws in the system and that there are people like Darryl who need to get back into court to be able to show for once and for all that they're innocent.
Can I just jump in?
Please.
And just make a quick comment? One way that I know that the system can, I know, make a dramatic change is that when you make deals with individuals to come in to testify, you're essentially paying them for testimony. And they're not experts. It's not like they're an expert witness. But if you're giving them gratuities, leniency, you know, probation, or letting them go, the defense can't do that. Defense cannot go into a county jail or a correction facility and say, look, we're going to make deals with you to come and testify for the defense. So that's fundamentally unfair right there on its face. Eliminate that. Just don't make deals with individuals. If they're going to give some testimony, you know, independent of any kind of deal, then that's one thing. But if you're going to pay them to come and testify, that sets the system up for failure right there.
Hmm. Is bribery rife in
well,
the legal system?
I mean, it is. What we call snitch testimony or informer testimony is a huge problem in the system where people are receiving deals or money or any other kinds of compensation for testimony. And there's certainly legislation that's being looked at around the country that would prevent that kind of testimony or require a judge to make some sort of finding on that kind of testimony before a jury ever heard it. So certainly that is one of the problems we're looking at in the system, and it's one that really needs to be addressed. I also wanted to say that one of the ways that we can really help in this process is to support innocence centers. There are innocence projects all over this country that support different states. The Rocky Mountain Innocence Center supports Utah, Wyoming, and Nevada and looks at wrongful convictions in all of those states. And as Daryl says, these organizations tend to be underfunded. They tend to be privately funded, and they can only take on as many cases as their funds allow. So if it's something that you're interested in, certainly going to our website, which is rminnocence.org, and seeing how you can make a difference in looking at these cases and educating yourself and seeing what can be done, both in volunteer ways and monetarily to help, because what your help does is help people like Daryl. Mm.
Jency Anderson, professor of law at the University of Utah, also the president of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center, and Daryl Burton is with us. He was exonerated after being incarcerated for 24 years for a crime he did not commit. He'll be speaking about his experience this afternoon at 12:15 in the Sutherland Moot Courtroom at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. The event is free and open to the public. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Jency, one recent innocence case that's gotten a lot of attention locally is the Deborah Brown case, of course. She was convicted of murder in 1993. She was exonerated last year based on factual innocence. The state is appealing the Brown release. It was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in September. What's the status? Do we know anything?
It was actually argued in front of the Utah Supreme Court.
Excuse me,
but,
Utah Supreme Court.
Right now, we're simply waiting for a decision. Deborah Brown was found factually innocent. It was through our statute that has for non-DNA evidence in May of 2011.
Can you refresh our memories? What is factual innocence?
Factual innocence is a concept that says you had absolutely nothing to do with the crime for which you've been convicted. So there's nothing factually that can connect you with that. And that can be proven either through the use of DNA evidence or through the use of other kinds of evidence that show that you simply could not have been involved. And in Deborah's case, that involved a whole lot of different things. But the thing that really pushed the judge to find factual innocence was the fact that there were witnesses who had seen the victim alive at a time when Deborah had an alibi, and thus she could not have been the person who killed him. So she was, a judge in Ogden found that she simply could not, based on the facts, have been involved in the crime. The state originally said they were not going to appeal, and then 2 weeks later decided that they were going to appeal. And as you said, that was heard in September. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has no time limits on, and I'm sure that they will do it as quickly as they can. This is a landmark decision in Utah, and so I know that they'll take as much time as they need to really think through it and come back with the right decision. And we wait anxiously for that decision, and we hope it will be before Christmas, but we anticipate that it won't be until after the first of the year.
Hmm. Daryl Burton, what's your life been like since you were exonerated in 2008?
Yeah, it's been great. I got married last year. I had a chance to reunite with my daughter, who I saw, she was 7 months when I last saw her. I saw her about three times, and when I left the streets, when I came back, she was a young woman turning 26, and it's not like I would like it to be. Of course, she's a young woman, so she has her own life. She lived in Indiana, and she didn't really grow up knowing me. She grew up actually, you know, thinking someone else was a dad. But I'm in seminary school, so I'm in life. I'm moving forward with life. I'm doing what I need to do. I just like to say one other thing is that of all the people who are innocent in prison, one person is too many. But when you know, when Jency was talking about these stats, and so when you put 5% of the prisoners in the United States who are innocent, and if that's 5% of 2.3 million people, that's a lot of people. 1% of that number is 23,000 people. So, I mean, that's a lot of people. It's just way too many people who end up that shouldn't be there. But I mean, life is good for me, but I think about those who still are left behind. I just, every day, that's why I continue to go around the country, around the world, and lend my voice to this cause, because there are a lot of causes. And I just happen to be chosen for this one, unfortunately through wrongful conviction, but, you know, it is what it is.
You've spoken and written about your emotions. You said earlier during our discussion that the early days were dark. You were very, very angry. But that anger led you, I guess it motivated you and led you to a faith that sustains you?
Yes, that anger. I used the anger to go into the law library and fight this case. Like I told the judge, I was going to fight the case till I prove I was innocent. That's what I said the last day in the courtroom. And that's what I used the anger for. It could have went another way, though, because prison, what I'm not talking about today on this radio broadcast, is that prisons is hell. It's literally hell on earth. I didn't go in a believer. I was not a Christian. I was not a believer in anybody's God. But I knew evil when I saw it, and I'm talking about evil top down, administrators, some of them, guards, people who worked there, many inmates were just, some of them were just evil. And the banner that was seen coming through the door said, "Leave all your hopes, family, and dreams behind," in the Missouri State Penitentiary. That's what it said as you entered that place. And so just, you know, having to live inside an environment like that without God is, for me, that's a miracle. My grandmother prayed for me and others prayed for me, but I didn't pray for myself. And at some point, I mean, of all the letters I wrote, I literally wrote a letter to Jesus Christ, a challenge. It wasn't a prayer, it wasn't a plea. And I said, "If you're real, you and I know I'm innocent, help me get out of this place and I'll serve you and tell the world about you." That's what I said. "Sincerely yours, Daryl Burton." Didn't have a mailing address and didn't really think much of the letter because I didn't believe in Jesus or in God. But 2 years after I wrote that letter, this organization called Centurion Ministries took my case, which got the name from the Bible when Jesus was crucified at Calvary. The man who founded the organization, his name is James, one of Jesus' apostles, and one of his brothers' name is James. The lead attorney who has a law firm in Kansas City, Missouri, who got me out of prison and helped get me out, her name is Cheryl Pilate, as in Pontius Pilate. So it was all these things that were just lining up that couldn't be coincidences. But as an unbeliever, I mean, I still just chalked it off. And I just needed a little bit more until I read what Jesus was talking about, forgiveness and love your enemy and pray for these people. I mean, a lot of things that just biblically just didn't line up with me and the human, in my human understanding. But I started doing what Jesus said, and it brought a peace inside of my heart. And so it freed me from a spiritual self-imposed prison. And so when I was free from that and I start forgiving those people, it didn't really, you know, make a lot of difference to me at that point. I was okay with whatever happened at that point. And so when I came home, I was already free. I was free inside of me. And being free physically was just, you know, it was just icing on the cake.
Daryl Burton, he was exonerated in 2008, now a motivational speaker. He's sharing his story at the University of Utah Quinney College of Law in the Sutherland Moot Courtroom this afternoon at 12:15. The event is free and open to the public, and it includes a complimentary lunch. And Daryl Burton, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for the time, and good luck to you.
Well, thank you. And I just want to thank also Caleb Proxel. I might be pronouncing his name wrong, but he's the one who actually I met in Utah at the Trial Lawyers College who inspired me to come out here and give this talk.
Caleb, so, well done. Caleb, a law student at the University of Utah. Also, Jency Anderson, clinical professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, president of the Rocky Mountain Innocence Center. Jency, thank you so much for the time.
Oh, thank you.
801-355-TALK is our number. We're going to continue the show with a discussion about Diwali. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Diwali, the annual Festival of Lights, is one of the most important celebrations of the year for Hindus. Dwali is the focus of a series of upcoming events here at the City Library, and today on the program we're learning more about this holiday and the spiritual practices of Hinduism. Joining me in studio is Indra Neelamegam. She immigrated to the United States in the early 80s and frequently conducts lectures and workshops on Indian culture and Hinduism. She's been very involved in the Sri Ganesha Hindu Temple and India Cultural Center of Utah in South Jordan, and she's on the board of the Salt Lake Interfaith Roundtable. Indra, great to have you here. Thanks so much for the time.
Oh, thank you for having me here, and it's a pleasure.
Also with us, joining us by phone, Dr. Deepak Sarma. He's a professor of Hinduism and philosophy at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. He's the author of several books, including Classical Indian Philosophy, A Reader. Sarma has a PhD in the philosophy of religions from the University of Chicago. And again, he's joining us by phone from his office in, I believe it's Cleveland. Dr. Sarma, welcome. Thanks so much for the time.
Oh, thank you very much, Jennifer. It's a pleasure to be here in whatever way one is there.
Indeed. Both Indra and Dr. Sarma are part of the annual Cultural and Religious Pluralism Conference that's happening here at the City Library. This year's conference focuses on Diwali, a festival of lights, music, and unity. And there will be several events being held here at the City Library, starting with a film screening and discussion tonight, Thursday, November 29th. Dr. Sarma will deliver the keynote address this Saturday, December 1st at 2 o'clock here at the City Library. There's a lot more information through some links on our website, kcpw.org, if you want to check that out. But if you have questions or comments about Hinduism, or if you celebrate Diwali, what are the highlights of the festival for you? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Dr. Sarma, I'll start with you. It's called the Festival of Lights. Tell us about Diwali. What's involved?
Well, Diwali is indeed the Festival of Lights, also understood as the Garland of Lights. Bali means garland, so sometimes it's Diwali is also known as Deepavali, which is the Garland of Lights festival. And it's celebrated throughout India by a number of different communities, including the Hindu community. And so Jains celebrate it, Sikhs celebrate it, and each community offers its own narrative as to why it's important to celebrate Diwali. And broadly speaking, it's understood as a kind of a general welcoming or victory of good over not good, dharma over adharma, dutiful over not dutiful. And all the different traditions in India, as I said, Jainism, Sikhism, and the varieties of Hinduism embrace this sort of framework.
What's the history there? Did it evolve from one religious tradition, or is it more a cultural experience?
Well, that's a good question. When we think about the term religion, and it's a very peculiar thing to apply to the practices and beliefs that we see in India, and when you use the word cultural tradition, and in a way, it could be probably seen as a cultural tradition, and when we say it's a religious one, then we kind of remove it from other sort of social events. But perhaps it probably is better seen as a cultural tradition. And I think, as I said, a lot of the traditions embraced it. So I would be hard-pressed to say that there was only one tradition from which it began and others copied it. I'd say that it's a general sort of celebration that all the traditions, cultural traditions, let's say, of India have embraced. Hmm.
Indra Neelamegam, tell us how you celebrated Diwali when you were a child in India.
Well, Diwali is the most important, and it was very important wherever we were. We had to get back to grandma's house. It's almost like a Thanksgiving. Mm. And the greatest event about Diwali was we got new clothes. There was plenty of cooking of great foods that kids loved. And the most exciting thing was that is the one day we could set off fireworks or firecrackers, as they were called in India. So these were things that were culturally important. But underlying it all was this story, or many, many legends and stories by which Hindus learn their faith, were recounted. Krishna and his wife Satya overcame the evil demon of death and illness. There is this great king who gave away all his wealth, who was welcomed by his his people with a whole array of lights to celebrate. So your homes were bedecked with light. These days, the oil wick lamps are replaced by electric string lights. But whatever it is, there's light that dispels darkness. And for kids, it's a joyous time. It's vacation time. For women and men, it's shopping time, where you get extra money in the form of bonuses and gifts from work, which you just go and spend in the shops.
Of course. I understand it's a five-day festival.
The actual day is one day, which is follows the lunar calendar. So this year it was November 12th, which was a great event celebrated at the Sri Ganesha Hindu Temple and various homes and various community organizations. But the festival itself encompasses 5 days for some religious traditions, but depending on the community you hail from. So there's a day before the actual Diwali, which is the biggest shopping day. So that's given a little religious mantle so that you say that's the day you bring wealth into the home. So you go buy something that represents wealth, which could be any metal, preferably gold or silver. So even if it's a dot of it, you bring it into the house. That's Dhanteras. That means that's the day you accumulate all this wealth back into the home. Then the second day, which is the main event, is the big celebration. It's followed by a New Year celebration for some communities, particularly communities of northern India. It's not a New Year for other parts of India, but for a certain community. So the third day becomes that. Then the fourth day is a special day to celebrate brothers and sisterly love. So that's Bhai Dooj. So there you have all these other community events conglomerating along with Diwali. So Diwali becomes a week-long festival.
Am I saying that right? Diwali? Diwali?
Yes, Diwali or Deepavali, as we say it in southern India.
Okay, well.
It's the same word pronounced differently.
Very good. Indra Neela Megham is with us. She is frequently involved with the Sri Ganesha Hindu Temple and India Cultural Center in South Jordan, also on the board of the Salt Lake Interfaith Roundtable. And she's moderating a panel tonight that is following a film we'll be talking about in a moment. Also with us on the phone, Dr. Deepak Sarma, professor of Hinduism and philosophy at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. And we're talking about Diwali, and the celebration of lights, the festival of lights that is being talked about and commemorated at an event at the City Library this weekend. Again, a film screening tonight, lectures, and the keynote address on Saturday. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Dr. Sarma, India is a very large and diverse country, as many of us know. Your keynote address is titled Diwali and its pluralistic approach to the global world. How does this festival of lights, you know, celebrate diversity?
Well, that's a good question. I'm working on my paper right now, and as we speak, and you know, it's really interesting how, as I said in my early remarks, that so many different traditions, cultural traditions in India have celebrate Diwali. And so in an interesting way, Diwali is a placeholder for a kind of pluralistic set of practices. And this is heightened even more so in diaspora, first diaspora Hindus and for Indian immigrants, that it has been a really interesting way to kind of unify the diversity of India and the diversity of the cultures and languages and beliefs all found within India. And I think it's actually an interesting metaphor for our approach to global diversity as a whole. And I think that it's a kind of microcosm of a macrocosm, or the reverse, a macrocosm of a microcosm. And those are sort of the things I'm going to address in my talk about how Diwali has come to be, certainly in diaspora, a really unifier and welcoming sort of tradition for people throughout South Asia, throughout India. And now that it's become part of the American religious landscape, it's become it's a welcoming, unifying tradition for people of America as well.
Indra, you're nodding your head to everything Dr. Sarma is saying.
Yeah, and you know, I agree with him because Diwali has become like a touchstone to bring communities together. When I came to Utah 30 years ago, we celebrated Diwali in the university with all the students, all the families that were there, which would be like about 20, 25 people, including Babes in Arms, which has now grown to be about almost 2,000 people celebrating it in the temple. In fact, the Diwali was the kind of a bringing together event that brought people from diverse backgrounds, the Indian heritage people spread all over the world, Fiji, Malaysia, Singapore, Sri Lanka, India, Pakistan, anywhere in the world, who came to the United States with aspirations. They had a cultural focus in a Diwali celebration, which kind of grew into community organization, cultural organizations, associations, whatever you call, eventually grew into a temple in Utah, which you know, is functioning with a large, in the beginning we had a trouble collecting even $11 a month to fund the prayer ceremonies. Now it's a full-fledged organization catering to the needs of more than 2,000 people, with a big celebration, huge fireworks, where the whole community, not just the Hindu community, but the extended community of Utah participates. And then it results in organizations like the City Main Library welcoming us to celebrate it, to enjoy it with everybody, not just of the Hindu tradition, but all faith traditions. For example, the Interfaith Roundtable, which represents so many religions, which the diversity in Utah, which we brought out from the Winter Olympics, and we have continued the tradition. Each year we emphasize one faith group. This year our emphasis is on Diwali and the Hindu faiths, and the whole pluralism conference, which is an emphasis on showing the diverse religions and the commonality between different faith traditions and believers, non-believers, whatever you have, brings this kind of a conference is very important to show everyone what's happening. And it's also an opportunity to learn about other faiths. And this year, Diwali is the greatest thing. You have cultural events, you have panel discussions, you have serious question and answer sessions. And more important, this lovely little documentary, which is just 60 minutes long, it's free, that's available to come and discuss and ask all the questions, all the doubts. No question is wrong and no answer is wrong. Everything is a discussion.
Let's talk about that. The screening of the film titled India, Love and Devotion, that's happening tonight. Tell us a little bit more about the documentary and how Hinduism really influences the daily life of Indians.
In America, we are we say we are a country obsessed with religion and sex. Both are very important facets of human beings, which is true for India too. And religion doesn't play the same kind of role as it does in the Americas, but it's still so integral part of life. We do not know where religion separates from cultural or heritage or what is a tradition. For example, a simple thing like the dot on my forehead. If you ask the common man, they'll think it's that religion. And to me, there's no religious text that says I wear this dot on my head. Yet, I do not feel Hindu. I do not feel Indian if I don't wear it, being from the traditional older generation. That is so part and parcel of me. I do not know if it's faith or is it culture or it's heritage or it's just the modern dress situation. Do you want me to touch a little bit about the movie?
Sure. Maybe about a minute.
Okay. The movie is it's a documentary produced by a gentleman who came to India. And like all things, there's a story saying five blind men looked at an elephant and each said it looks like a snake. The other said it looks like a fan. The other said it looks like a big couch. So this documentary is like that. Here is a viewpoint of India. All the exotic that you hear and see about India is brought together and then with a little interpretation. But the greatest point about that this movie makes is it talks about various faiths that have their origin in India. Hinduism, of course, which is the basis. Then there is Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, the Muslim tradition. India has the largest Muslim community in the world next to only Indonesia. Not many are aware of that. So there's a little bit of every faith that thrives and lives in India in this documentary. And then it also shows daily life of a farming community in northern India. It's exotic, it's beautiful, it will help you ask a lot of questions, and it may even find answers for many questions you have.
Dr. Sarma, we've only got about a minute left. I'm just wondering what you think that non-Hindus, non-Jains, those who do not understand or know about the Diwali tradition, what can they take that from this holiday?
Well, I think that in really practical terms, I think that there's a growing number of Hindus and Jains in the American population now, and you might see them at work. You might see them at the hospital if you need a medical checkup, and they might be celebrating those traditions. And this might give you an opportunity to understand something about who they are. It might give you an opportunity to understand why they aren't going to come to work that day, let's say. I think that knowing something about the people around you is essential, and there are a growing number of Hindus and Jains in the world today and in America for sure, so it's really worth your while to know a little bit about important traditions that they're celebrating.
Are you finding that Diwali and the Hindu tradition is becoming more well-known, a little more mainstream?
I think so. I mean, we see references to Diwali in The Office, the television program The Office, which either means it's mainstream or it's a good something to laugh about. But perhaps things to laugh about are indicators of them becoming mainstream.
So I should add a point here, Dr. Sarma.
Very quickly, Indra.
Yeah, even Diwali was celebrated in the White House, and it was broadcast over the NASDAQ notice board. So that is mainstream, if nothing else.
There you go.
Indra Neelamegham, she is involved with the Sri Ganesha Hindu temple in South Jordan, also on the board of the Salt Lake Interfaith Roundtable. Indra, great to have you. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, folks.
And Dr. Deepak Sarma, he is a professor of Hinduism and philosophy at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, coming to Salt Lake City to deliver the keynote address for this year's annual Cultural and Religious Pluralism Conference. Dr. Sarma, thank you as well.
Sure, a great pleasure and a privilege, and I can assure you that my talk will be provocative and interesting.
Terrific. You can find out a lot more about the entire Diwali discussion on our website, kcpw.org. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.